We're talking renewables and hearing a case for investing in more nuclear plants on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Sometimes it takes a depth of winter cold snap here in Wisconsin to help us realize just how much we need heat, how much we need light, that electricity is vital to our survival. We're exploring a new book that makes a case for getting off of fossil fuels and doubling down on nuclear. What source of energy do you think is our best bet? What's your take on nuclear power? Do you live near a plant, and what's that experience like? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Joshua Goldstein is an author and professor emeritus of international relations at American University. He's co-authored a book. It's called A Bright Future: How Some Countries Solved Climate Change and the Rest Can Follow. Joshua, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with how we got here. You say there are a couple kinds of changes when it comes to the climate. Can you break down for us what is happening, what we're seeing?
So right now we're seeing little changes in the climate. Droughts, hurricanes, floods, and these get attention, and we feel like climate change is already happening. And that's true, but only in the very advanced little aspects of it. What's coming is far worse and far more dramatic. We really have the lives of our children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren on the line in what we do now that's going to affect their future. The worst tipping points that might happen, and there's a lot of uncertainty about it, but later in the century and next century, we could see another ice age in North America. We could see a dramatic sea level rise, 20 feet or more. And that's very hard when most of the cities are along the coast, obviously not in Wisconsin.
A recent report says that we're already at a tipping point in Greenland. The massive ice sheets there are melting much faster than predicted, and that means sea levels will rise. What is your reaction on that news, on that front?
Well, we've had a whole series of reports now that underscore how urgent this problem is and how serious it is. The thing people, I think, haven't yet come to terms with is the scale of action that's needed to get on top of this. The world is using a lot of electricity, 80-some percent of it from fossil fuels and other energy from fossil fuels. By mid-century, the climate scientists tell us we should be off of fossil fuels. That's just 30 years away. It's a massive transition. And in addition to today's electricity grid, which we need to shift off fossil fuels, then we need to electrify transportation and heating and industry. Eventually, we need to start sucking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. All of this requires vast amounts of new, cheap, clean electricity sources. And right now, nobody has a plan where it's coming from.
And that plan could come from policymakers in part. It's no secret, though, that climate change has become this entrenched political issue. Can you explain how conservatives and liberals have both contributed to this state of inaction, perhaps, that we're seeing?
Sure. Climate change was not a partisan issue a few decades ago, but it became a partisan issue along with everything else in the country. And it's like, if Al Gore is for it, I'm against it, or vice versa. The conservative wing of the Republican Party now doesn't want to deal with climate change because they're afraid it's going to be expensive, it's going to involve bigger government, more taxes. And so they're like, we're in denial. We don't, it doesn't exist. Not our problem. We'll be dead. Right. And then the liberal wing of the Democratic Party is like, wait, we have children and grandchildren. We have to solve this problem. And we want to get rid of fossil fuels, but we want to do it in a way that's never been done and actually has been shown not to work, which is just put all our eggs in one basket, which is renewables. And it's almost an ideology, 100% renewables. I think Madison has a policy on that.
And we're going to be getting to that a little bit later. We're talking with Joshua Goldstein. He's author of A Bright Future: How Some Countries Solved Climate Change and the Rest Can Follow. What has your response been to the dire climate change estimates? Are you concerned we're not doing enough to protect our future? How would you like scientists and policymakers to work together? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Paris.org. Joshua, the Paris Agreement is the only worldwide pact to combat the problem of climate change. We're seeing a little bit of movement. A House Democrat in California is pushing for a measure that would rebuke President Trump's decision to pull out of the Paris Agreement, but that's legislation in its infancy. So you say the Paris Agreement doesn't go far enough. Where does it fall short?
Well, the Paris Agreement, if it worked, and it's not working, nobody's keeping their commitments under the Paris Agreement. If everybody kept their commitments and we did everything we agreed on, it would only level out the emission of carbon into the atmosphere at today's levels. That's not what we need. We need to drop them rapidly, several percent every year for the next 30 years. And the Paris Agreement just doesn't do that. And in fact, nothing that we've been doing works so far. There's a lot of talk, there's a lot of politics, and a lot of little steps, but they're not adding up to a solution.
So let's look at fossil fuel carbon emissions. You say coming from several sources, electricity generation, coming from transportation, heat for buildings and industry. Why do you think focusing on electricity will be the most successful aspect of combating climate change?
Well, three-quarters of the carbon going into the atmosphere, one-quarter is from agriculture and land use. That's a kind of a separate track. Three-quarters is from energy use. And the energy that's not already electricity, and most of that is not electrified now, either we have to electrify it directly, like drive electric cars or heat buildings with electricity, or we need to create substitute fuels, like you can run diesel engines on ammonia that you can make from hydrogen and nitrogen, but you need electricity to do that. So it all comes back to electricity is the linchpin of being able to decarbonize, get rid of the carbon-based fuels.
You looked across the world for some answers here, and what other countries are doing? Finland, Sweden, France, you went Canada, and you had some aha moments along the way, but you kept coming back to nuclear. So what is it? I mean, you're making a hard push here. What is it about nuclear?
So there's a website anybody can go to called electricitymap.org, and it shows how much carbon is being emitted for every kilowatt hour of electricity produced all around the world. And you can see, you know, the green ones hardly emit any carbon, the brown ones quite a bit. Wisconsin's pretty brown, actually. It's more than half coal. And China's coal, and, you know, India's using coal. That's kind of the go-to fuel in the world. But there are places that are green on this map that are hardly emitting any carbon, and that would be Sweden, France, Ontario. Day in, day out, winter, summer, day and night, they're green. And the reason is each one of them rolled out nuclear power. They did it rapidly in just 10 or 20 years, built one reactor after another, and got the fossil fuels off their grid and replaced it with nuclear power. So we know this is feasible. It's been done. All we have to do is replicate that model.
Joshua Goldstein is with us. He is an author. He's a professor emeritus of international relations at American University. Co-authored the new book, A Bright Future, How Some Countries Solved Climate Change and the Rest Can Follow. How would you like scientists and policymakers to work together? Should this be handled by the federal government or the states? What would you like to see happen here in Wisconsin with the energy grid? The number is 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. The book is called A Bright Future. We're discussing what's happened as countries like Sweden, Finland, and France have moved to low-carbon electricity options. We're talking nuclear energy here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Consider this. Every year, almost 100 million people get access to electricity for the very first time. There is growing demand, and we're looking at ways to meet that demand and hearing your thoughts along the way at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Author Joshua Goldstein stays with us. He's author of the book, A Bright Future. Let's go to Jonathan now, joining us from Madison. Hi, Jonathan. What's on your mind?
What's on my mind this morning has to do with his comment about the comments about climate change and how we can mitigate it, and the need for possibly creating a technology for that. And the technology already exists through photosynthesis, and there's research out there that shows that if we can raise our agricultural soils around the world about 1%, we can sequester nearly all the carbon that we've released from the soil and into the atmosphere over the last century. And I feel like this could be a great way to incentivize farmers by encouraging them and finding some way to compensate them for sequestering this carbon. And there's regenerative farmers all over the world that are starting to do this. And one, Gabe Brown in North Dakota, he's been growing, he grows on about 2,000 acres of land, and he's been growing his organic matter by roughly 0.5% per year for the last 20 years.
Joshua, let's get, Jonathan, let's get Joshua's thoughts on this.
Well, that's a great idea, and the agricultural piece of this is important, but it's not going to solve the problem. In fact, there's no silver bullet that's going to solve this. We need to be doing everything. We need to be changing land use practices. We need to be working on efficiency and putting in renewables, and then we're still going to have a big gap, something that needs to grow really fast, and that's where nuclear power comes in.
Before we get to nuclear power, Sarah and Viola would love to make a comment. Sarah, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, with nuclear power, we have nuclear waste, and we still have not figured out a good way to deal with that. I've been reading about studying climate change and peak oil and resource depletion for over a decade, and I am convinced that the answer is what your previous caller said, plus relocalizing our energy uses, not making it big, making it small, and bringing it back not only to communities but even to individual houses.
Sarah, thanks for the call. What about the waste?
So nuclear waste is very misunderstood, and what people don't understand is how small it is. Nuclear is incredibly concentrated. And just to back up for a second, if you take a lump of coal, a pound of coal, and turn it into electricity, you can power your house for about an hour. But if you take a pound of nuclear fuel, you can power your house for 2 years. So it's just vastly more concentrated. And what it means is that on the other end, the waste end, the vast amounts of coal waste that we just stick in sludge behind dams and forget about until it leaks into the water. By contrast, nuclear power creates much, much smaller amounts. Right now in the United States, we put it in cooling pools for a couple of years and it gets less radioactive. And then we put it in concrete casks, about 18 feet high cylinders, and we put it out behind the existing nuclear power plants. A 1 gigawatt plant, which is a big plant, will produce about 2 of those cylinders per year. And it sits out back there. They're safe. We've never had a problem with them. They're good for decades into the future. And those are the decades when we need to be decarbonizing the world. Afterwards, we can either create new reactors, which are being designed now, that can burn that waste as fuel, which is an elegant solution, or we can stick it underground the way Finland is doing in long-term places. But it's not a threat. It's not an urgent problem the way climate change is an urgent problem.
I was going to ask you about Finland, because it sounds like Finland has made an ability to deal with that waste in a different way.
Yeah. So the quantities, the entire United States, 60 years of nuclear power would, if you put it all in one place, it would cover a football field about 20 feet high. That's for the whole country. So Finland's a smaller country, and theirs is smaller. They've created tunnels underground, a long-term repository. They put the waste into casks, they pack it with clay, they bury it in the bedrock. It's certified, you know, for long, long-term storage there. And they did a study. What if everything went wrong and the cask were to leak and the clay were to disappear? Then somebody lives their whole life on top of that 1,000 years from now. How much radiation would they get? And the answer was about the amount in a bunch of bananas. Bananas have potassium in them. They're very slightly radioactive. So people think that nuclear waste is like something that if a little bit leaks, it's going to destroy the world. It's not like that at all. Radiation is among us all the time. If we have some leak of nuclear waste 1,000 years from now, it's a tiny price to pay for solving the real problem that we're leaving for our children, which is this planet overheated and unlivable.
But we think of Three Mile Island. We think of Fukushima. We think of Chernobyl. These are real disasters, and nuclear is attached to that.
Right, in the public imagination. So Three Mile Island was an accident that caused an expensive damage to a plant. It didn't actually hurt anybody, but it happened just when this film, The China Syndrome, was in the theaters and people crosswired it in their brains. Fukushima happened in the context of an epic natural disaster. This 50-foot tsunami and the world's fourth largest earthquake killed almost 20,000 people, and then it damaged the plant and some radiation leaked, but the radiation was never above the level that you could go get medical scans, and there's a safety limit of how much radiation you're supposed to get occupationally or medically, and it never rose above that safety level for the general public. The evacuation was bad and harmful, but the plant itself didn't harm anybody. Now, Chernobyl's another case. That was a badly designed, badly run Soviet plant 30 years ago, and it did kill some dozens of people right away and possibly as many as a few thousand over time. But compare that with coal, which is killing hundreds of thousands of people every year, and literally hundreds of people in Wisconsin every year. That's more people than Chernobyl killed.
Let's bring in another call now. Let's go to Avery joining us from Platteville. Hi, Avery.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. What a very interesting topic, and your speaker is very well informed. I do believe that nuclear energy is the wave of the future. However, I am concerned as a resident of the state of Washington during the mid-90s when the entire state, county by county, put up municipal bonds to start 5 nuclear power plants. Let's not forget, they were one of the first to make fissionable material for atomic bombs, so they were on the very brink of this. And the cost overruns of the first plant not only shut down the other 4 plants that were already started, but almost bankrupted the entire state of Washington.
Avery, thank you for the call. Let's look at the cost of these reactors.
Yeah. In the United States, we can't seem to build a nuclear reactor now for a reasonable price at all. We didn't do it for 30 years. Then we came up with a new design, first of a kind. That's always more expensive, the first one off the line. And then we changed the safety rules and the designs after construction. It started just a complete mess, and these plants are going way over budget. In South Korea and Sweden and France, they built the same design repeatedly. And South Korea can build a nuclear power plant for about 1/6 what the United States can, exact same, you know, design. The plants that we're trying to build in the United States, AP1000, it's a Westinghouse design, and we tried to build 4 of them. 2 have already been canceled, the other 2 way over budget, way behind schedule. China just opened 4 of those in the last year, same exact design. So we have trouble with big capital projects, be it bridges, highways, trains, or nuclear power plants. And that's part of the problem. Maybe we need to think about nuclear plants more as a public good and something long-term that we invest in as a society, because in a deregulated market, it's really hard, even if you can build it at the South Korean price, to get billions of dollars up front for something that's going to last 60 to 80 years. that's a hard sell in a capitalist deregulated economy.
How are the funding models coming together for nuclear here in the U.S., and where is that funding coming from?
The places in the world that nuclear has been most successful have pretty strong government support. Sweden was a mix of private and public. France was just all public government. In the United States, utilities have tried to put together the money. It's hard to do it. It's hard to build a new plant. What we have is startups that are trying to build smaller, cheaper nuclear power plants. And part of the reason is exactly this economic problem, because if you build a smaller plant at a fraction of the price, it's much easier to raise the capital and get into business. So there are about 50 startups now working on new designs. Most of them are smaller and cheaper, and that may be where the future is for the United States.
Talking with Joshua Goldstein, he is an author and professor emeritus of international relations at American University. He co-authored the new book, A Bright Future, How Some Countries Solved Climate Change and the Rest Can Follow. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. What is the solution? Let's look at solutions coming up. Up next, it's news, and then we continue the conversation here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. More than a billion people in the world lack access to electricity. A quarter of those people live in India. That's a World Bank statistic cited in the new book, A Bright Future, How Some Countries Have Solved Climate Change and the Rest Can Follow. We're talking about the politics around creating sustainable sources of energy and how to create more energy with less fossil fuels in the mix. We're looking at how to develop a carbon pricing structure that works for the world and how to pay for carbon pollution. Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has stressed the importance of a carbon tax.
By putting a price on pollution makes sense to both ensure that we're getting the good jobs that come out of this and also protect our environment, because people know that the environment and the economy have to go together.
You can join in with your questions, your insights, 800-642-1234. Do you think it's possible for the world to phase out coal and natural gas? Should the government provide incentives to encourage nuclear and renewable energy and dissuade companies from less environmental but cheaper options like natural gas? Author Joshua Goldstein stays with us. He's a professor emeritus of international relations at American University. Looking at what we just heard there from Justin Trudeau, the Prime Minister, and a carbon tax, how good is the world at coming together on what a feasible carbon tax would be?
It's been very difficult politically to put a price on carbon pollution. Even though it's a great idea, economists all love it, and it's certainly something we should be doing if we want to stop climate change. The places that have done it successfully, I would put Sweden at the top of the list. They have a very steep carbon tax, very steep. And this was after they got rid of fossil fuels on their electric grid and replaced with nuclear power. Then they put in a big carbon tax, and it helped to drive change throughout the economy. If you put a price on pollution, then it takes effect quickly. It affects everything in the economy. It incentivizes the use of clean fuels. And so that's the good side of it. The bad side is, it's in many places, it's been hard politically because people don't want to pay more for energy. Australia put in a carbon tax, and then the government lost power, and the new government took it away again. France tried to raise gas prices recently, and people turned out in the streets to oppose it. So that's the tricky part. There's a proposal in Congress now in the United States to price carbon pollution, and then rebate that money back to the citizens in the form of a monthly rebate to every household. So you'd get the rebate regardless of how much dirty or clean energy you used, but the incentive would be to use clean energy because you're not paying the tax on that.
Let's bring another call now. Let's go to Michael joining us from La Crosse. Hi, Michael.
Hi. I was wondering, I like your talk about the carbon tax. I really think it's important. But I was wondering if we could go back to the nuclear energy discussion. You talked a lot about the traditional side of, like, nuclear fission for energy. But I was wondering about the feasibility for technology like nuclear fusion that's being like developed in projects like ITER.
Michael, thanks for the call. Fusion and fission, we're going to need to break some of this down.
Okay, fission is the process of splitting a big atom and getting energy out of it. Fusion, you take a couple of little atoms and fuse them together. It's how the sun works. The trouble is that you need really, really high temperatures to make those atoms fuse, and so it's been elusive. They say it's always 30 years in the future, and it always will be, but now there's some breakthroughs, and it looks like it really might be only 30 years in the future. The trouble is we need something now. We really need something to take us through the next 30 years, a proven solution, and that's where nuclear fission, nuclear power as we know it, has already worked. What we need to do is to standardize designs the way the Swedish and French did, and crank them out like more like a Boeing jetliner coming off an assembly line and less like a site-specific construction that's changing all the time. A quip from a Nuclear Regulatory Commission chair a while ago was that the French have two kinds of reactors and 100 kinds of cheese, and it's the reverse in the United States. So we need to be more like the French, maybe on both the cheese and the...
Oh, but you're in Wisconsin, so we're cheese heavy here. So looking at the electric grid for a moment, would there be more hope for 100% renewables if we had a more sophisticated grid and reliable ways to store the energy, use it when we need it?
This is the problem. We don't have reliable ways to store the energy. There's nothing on the horizon. We're not about to get super cheap storage of electricity at large scale. I mean, we can put in batteries. So far, they mostly just even out the grid when the sun goes down and there's a big shock, you know. But there's no large scale storage that's going to take you from solar power that you produced last summer and take you through a Wisconsin winter with it. You can do a lot with renewables when they're a small part of the grid, meaning, you know, maybe less than half. But that second half of the grid, it gets really hard because of the intermittency of the production, the variability, and you need something, a base power to fill in that.
Let's bring in Al now from La Crosse. Good morning, Al.
Good morning. Nuclear energy cannot possibly come online in sufficient time to produce any reduction in fossil fuel emissions and climate change. Renewable energy options are faster to deploy, can provide low-carbon power, cheaper, and without the risk of nuclear waste, and without the contamination that is the inevitable result of mining uranium to produce nuclear power from native lands in the United States and elsewhere.
So Al is looking more towards solar and wind.
This is what everybody thinks now, you know, just solar and wind, it's really fast, it's really cheap. It's not true. And you can look at the case of Germany, which had everything going for it on renewables, the political agreement on it, the technological ability. They went all out on it. It's a great example of how to put in renewables. And yet, at the end of all that, their carbon emissions haven't come down at all, basically. And they, if we kept going, if the world did what Germany did, it would take a century and a half to decarbonize the world economy. By contrast, if the world did what Sweden did when they put in nuclear power, you could do that in 30 years. So five times faster with nuclear power than renewables. And this is the reason. And the reason is because nuclear is so concentrated. You know, one little nuclear plant produces 15% of Wisconsin energy. That's really, really powerful. If you built six or eight of those in the next 15, 20 years, you would have all of Wisconsin's energy. You know, it's really fast to deploy, and that's why it's got to be part of the solution.
Let's bring in Jim now to the conversation. Jim, joining us from Cedarburg.
Morning. I'd like to ask the guest about the cost of lawsuits at Fukushima. My understanding is there's plutonium leakage into the ocean over there. I can't think of anything more deadly than plutonium. And also decommissioning costs of a reactor. We had one on the eastern shore of Lake Michigan. I think it's called Brookhaven. How much does it cost? And finally, who pays for these?
Lots of questions there to unpack from Jim. And who pays when you decommission?
That's built into the price of electricity. The money is put aside so that the plant can be decommissioned and the waste can be stored away. I can think of something more deadly than plutonium, and that's coal. Coal is killing hundreds of thousands every year. Plutonium hasn't killed anybody in significant numbers since we dropped atomic bombs. That's another whole thing. People get confused, nuclear weapons with nuclear power, two completely different things. But the Fukushima waste has not hurt anybody, has not leaked out. There were some people who were, you know, responders on the plant, a dozen people who did get some high radiation dose. None of them died. And the little bit that's leaking into the ocean is diffused by the ocean, not concentrated, and becomes harmless.
Let's bring in Vern now from Stanley. Vern, go ahead.
Good morning. The nuclear reactor we should have been building is a liquid metal cooled nuclear breeder reactor. There are 750 years of stored radioactive material at Paducah, Kentucky that we could use. But what you're forgetting, these vessels, Fukushima is a lot worse than what you're telling us. Now, these reactors are made out of stainless steel, the cores, well, they're welded. And we're running on cracked reactors because the neutrons, they migrate to copper because they copper-coated the stainless steel wire that was used to weld them. And they also have what's called hydrogen embrittlement in the reactors.
So Vern is bringing up that reactors do have cracks, and that's a safety issue.
Well, reactors get certified very, very carefully by the NRC, Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and they're certified for usually 60 years or more. The safety record speaks for itself. Nobody's ever died from nuclear power in the United States over 60 years.
So as you look across the U.S. and not across the world, are there places you see openings where people are going toward nuclear and communities are doing unique things that may not be happening in other parts of the country?
Well, one place it's happening, surprisingly, is in the U.S. Congress. Despite all the partisan gridlock on so many issues, one thing Congress agrees on across the parties is clean energy solutions. They don't agree on what the problem, climate change. But the Nuclear Energy Innovation and Modernization Act is supporting this new generation of reactors, and it just passed with a huge bipartisan majority in Congress. And then these 50 startups around the country, very hopeful. They're working on, you know, better reactor designs. We don't need to be building the same thing as 30 years ago. And what we hope to get to with that is building smaller, cheaper, easily deployed reactors in shipyards or in factories to bring down the price below fossil fuels. That's the ideal. Then you don't need to rely on a carbon tax to make them competitive on the grid.
Well, Joshua, thank you for joining us.
Well, it's been a pleasure being here. There's a website with more information at brightfuturebook.com. I know it's a controversial topic, so let's keep up the discussion.
Joshua Goldstein is an author and professor emeritus of international relations at American University, co-authored the new book, A Bright Future, How Some Countries Solved Climate Change and the Rest to Follow. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Wisconsin Energy Institute is a research center at UW-Madison, and hundreds of scientists who are affiliated with the center are working on advancing biofuels and rethinking the electric grid to find breakthroughs for clean energy. We're getting an update now on the research with Paul Wilson. He is a UW-Madison engineering physics professor. He chairs the Energy Analysis and Policy Graduate Certificate Program. He also serves on the board of directors for the American Nuclear Society. Paul, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, give us the lay of the land in Wisconsin. What does our state's energy map look like? Joshua earlier said there's a lot of brown with coal.
Right. Wisconsin still relies very heavily on coal, as it has for decades. There used to be three nuclear reactors at two power plants. And about 5 years ago, nearly 6 years ago, one of those shut down. And so there's two reactors at one power plant in Point Beach. They provide about 15% of the electricity. Wisconsin also has a renewable portfolio standard, which mandates that some fraction of our electricity comes from renewable sources, and that's more than 10%. So the bulk of the rest of it is coming from coal and natural gas, and the majority of that is still coal.
And when you say a renewable portfolio standard, what does that mean?
So that was a legislation passed over 15 years ago, nearly 20 years ago, that requires the utilities of Wisconsin to get a certain fraction of their electricity from a collection of technologies, wind, solar, biomass, small hydro, and there's certain things, and a few other options.
So is renewable energy on the growth in Wisconsin? Is it pretty stagnant? How is it trending?
Renewable energy is always growing. There's various programs by the utilities, the local and the larger scale utilities. Local utilities have programs to help homeowners get solar or buy into community-supported solar power, for example, here in Madison. And there's larger installations going in, typically wind and some solar. But the total contribution is small, and so even a large growth rate doesn't necessarily mean a large contribution right now.
So Joshua laid out his point of going nuclear. When you look at Wisconsin, what are the chances of that? And what is Wisconsin's situation in that area?
So Wisconsin used to have legislation that prevented nuclear energy being deployed without a number of conditions being true. And that was overturned about 2 years ago, nearly 3 years ago. So it's possible to build new nuclear power plants in Wisconsin today. The energy market and the energy system in Wisconsin doesn't, I don't think, have enough growth and energy in it to really support the building of a new nuclear power plant today. I think importantly, it is now required when utilities want to deploy new generation capacity, they have to include in their alternatives nuclear energy and rule out why they're not pursuing nuclear energy. And so that gets it in the conversation and allows us to think about doing it in the future.
What happens to the site of a plant when it closes? How does the closing impact that plant and the surrounding community?
So when Kewaunee closed, I think it had a really severe impact on the local community. It was a large part of the economic base of the Kewaunee County. There were a few hundred high-tech, high-paying jobs that supported that community. And the closure came rather suddenly. All nuclear power plants are going to have to close at some point, but most communities have time to prepare for that if they know that it's going to happen 20 years in the future. Kewaunee had just been relicensed for 20 more years, and so everyone expected it to operate for the full 20 years, and only a few years into that license did they decide to close it down with about a year's notice. And so it had a pretty devastating impact on that economy.
What is the lifetime of a power plant, of a reactor, and can we extend it?
So nuclear power plants initially are licensed for 40 years by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And at the end of that, or towards the end of that, the owner has the option to seek an extension. Many of them do. The way that the economy is for electricity, most of that plant is paid off. And so most owners find that it's economically viable to extend the license for 20 years. Some of those plants now are at the end of 60 years, and some of the owners are looking at another 20-year extension.
When you look internally at the Wisconsin Energy Institute, what is some research on nuclear that might impact where we go with it in the future?
So we do a lot of work on advanced reactor designs. One of the most interesting ones is something called a molten salt reactor, where all the fuel is mixed in with the fluid, and so it allows for a lot of opportunities to operate a reactor very differently in safety benefits, waste management benefits, uranium resource benefits.
Let's go to a call now. Let's go to Simon joining us from Madison. Simon, hi.
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to get the guest take on how far off we are, I guess, globally on fusion power, whether that's fusion microgrids or on large scale. I know that there's a lot of research being done all over the world and some advances on semiconductors and different materials that can be used to house that reaction.
So Simon is saying, is fusion a breakthrough here?
So fusion has always been sort of an exciting option for the future. Unfortunately, it's always seemed to be far in the future. The conventional path that we're pursuing with a lot of government funding is focused right now on a large facility in France that'll come online in the next 10 years and start giving us new information. Perhaps more exciting, in the last 10 years, there have been a number of startup companies. I think Joshua referred to some of them in the fission business, but there's also a few in the fusion business. And some of those are pretty aggressive and looking at new ways to, new paths that are not the sort of conservative government-funded path, taking bigger risks, but hoping to be getting there much sooner. And some of them suggest within 10 years they may be able to be successful.
When you look at advanced reactor designs and more sophisticated reactors, what is their path getting to the marketplace? Because reactors are so hard and long to build, and there's a lot of gridlock to get there. So where are they in the marketplace?
So that is certainly one of the challenges. Reactors, one of the big trends we see is reactors getting smaller. Through the history of nuclear energy in the United States, reactors tend to get bigger. There was a lot of economic benefit at that time. Right now, the benefit is really to make reactors smaller. Because it means that you need to raise less money to build each unit. So the most advanced of those is designed from a company called NuScale. They're currently getting their license certified by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and hope to build the first reactor in the western part of the United States, a much smaller. It'll be something like 30 times smaller than a typical nuclear power plant.
Why do you think Sweden is so successful with nuclear and the rest of the world can't seem to be on the same page with it?
I think there's certain things that look like they make a big difference in being successful, and one of them is having a national energy policy that really supports these kinds of collective action. And Sweden, one of the things about Sweden is it's a fairly small, relatively homogeneous country, and so getting consensus towards a single vision is much easier. And we see similar things in the Korean experience. They're a bigger country, but they've got a culture and a history that really sort of supports the idea of building consensus and all moving in the same direction.
Do you see any consensus building in the United States?
Well, Joshua did point to the fact that nuclear energy is really a bipartisan issue, and there's a lot of support on both sides of the aisle. That wasn't true 20 years ago. But I think more and more people are coming around to the realization that if we care about the climate, then nuclear energy has to be part of what we look at for that future.
So what is the next step for researchers in this? How can research make these reactors get to the marketplace sooner and be more successful once they're there? And drive the price down.
Right. I think that, one of the big questions is, can we drive the price down? From the research side, it's really showing how we can make some of these new concepts viable, answering questions about, topics about materials. And one of the big issues in most of engineering and nuclear engineering, it's true, is do we have the right materials to survive the environments? For some of these new reactor designs, the big benefits occur if we can demonstrate that the materials will survive in certain ways so that we can back away from some of the other concerns.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Paul Wilson is a nuclear engineering professor at UW-Madison. He chairs the Energy Analysis and Policy Graduate Certificate Program, serves on the board of directors for the American Nuclear Society. And earlier, we talked with author Joshua Goldstein about his new book, A Bright Future, How Some Countries Have Solved Climate Change and the Rest Can Follow. Just ahead, as the government shutdown continues, federal employees and contractors are feeling the financial strains. We discuss the experience of Americans who live paycheck to paycheck. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.